question.
Okay.
Good morning. Let's call this meeting to order. I am delighted to see all of the different state departments that are here this morning, as well as some of our members. We are not very clear as to who is going to be here this morning. Of course, we have a lot of responsibilities. Some members, probably the public know, are really running strong campaigns. They might not be able to get here from their different districts. They live in distant communities, and we have decided to call this meeting this morning because we really need to figure out how are we going to put a report that is due in January. So we are really running out of time, and it is very important that we begin to collect this information and figure out how do we work on a draft that it already exists, and then we can move from there. So members, if we maybe it will be timely to invite you to introduce yourselves, and then we will begin the conversation and move into. I do not believe that we have quorum for adopting the agenda, but let's go ahead and let's work with introductions.
I'm State Representative Paul Gardner, one of the two House members, and I represent all or part of six communities in Anoka and Ramsey counties.
I'm John Keller. I'm the director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota.
My name is Botao Urabi, and I work, I direct our grant-making program at Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, and Philanthropy.
Thank you, and welcome, our new members in the group. So we're delighted that you are able to work with us.
Bruce Corey, Concordia University.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. For the members, I believe we do have a quorum now to adopt the minutes, correct? I don't know. Correct? Do we? We have five people. No? Okay. I don't recall. We have, I believe, pretty much the same composition of the group that we had previously, but I'm not 100% sure. Members, I wanted to kind of point to you or remind you that the last time we met, we talked about a couple of things. One was actually three main things. The first one was that we wanted to have the opportunity to go around the state and hear from different people from around Minnesota, particularly rural Minnesota, because oftentimes we don't have the opportunity to hear those voices here. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, we just really don't have the budget to do major traveling. But we may be able to at least have one hearing in rural Minnesota, and we could think about a date that we could do that and hear from some of those perspectives in rural Minnesota. The second issue was that we have contemplated the idea of really looking at existing resources and looking at what the departments are currently doing to serve refugees and immigrants in different areas. And we determined that we will start with the major departments and really cover the issues that are really perhaps or have been discussed by this committee and other committees in both the Senate and the House in extensive ways, and that is health, education, and labor, and businesses. So we are looking into, employment and economic development is really the appropriate term. And so we're going to hear today from those three different departments and really try to figure out from those ideas, how do we extract information that we can put together into a draft that was put together early by this committee? So I don't know if you have any comments or any ideas at this point that you would like to share before we begin the presentations from these groups. Dr. Corey.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we're going to move forward in terms of that mm-hmm. report. I want to suggest something that might be helpful. You could just pass those two things around. In 2000, Governor Jesse Ventura appointed me to chair the Working Group on Minority Business Development. We had a group of people. We had statewide hearings. We issued a report on the emerging markets. But it was more than just a focus on the emerging markets. It was an invitation to Minnesota to look at our communities as assets and not as deficits, to look at how they contribute at different dimensions as entrepreneurs, as consumers, as workers, as cultural capital, as mm-hmm. trade networks. And this was 2000. And then we came out with an Emerging Market Alliance declaration that kind of summarized this vision of who we are. And that's basically the charge of even this commission of looking at ethnic heritage and new Americans and what they bring to the table. And so I want to bring something from the past that we had a framework in which we invited Minnesota to look mm-hmm. at our communities, and we asked the governor to sign it. And Governor Ventura signed it. And the second document is when he took it to the United States Senate. And here is what he says, which I think is kind of interesting. I strongly believe that Minnesota's potential in the world marketplace is proportional to the success we have in helping our minority communities thrive at home. We need to change the mindset about the potential of minority-owned businesses and embrace new communities who are adding more and value to our economy every day. As governor, I'm serious about helping to change this mindset in Minnesota. We must learn how to tap into the new immigrant energy that has taken hold of our state. And this declaration is being circulated in Minnesota called the Emerging Market Alliance Declaration. I have signed this declaration, and I encourage you to do the same. So basically, he embraced that new vision of immigrants and minorities in the state. Recently, the state issued a disparity study on the allocation or the distribution of state contracts to different groups. And we had approached our present governor, Governor Pulenty, and his staff about looking at this whole process in this light. And I'm happy to say that on the website of the Department of Administration, there's a strong statement that has this vision of entrepreneurship and looking at people as assets. And I think while this message has been well received, it'll be curious, and I'll be interested in hearing as the different departments present how this asset is integrated. I mean, this vision is integrated into the machinery, the policy machineries of the state and its various institutions, and how people are responding to it. And what I would suggest is that one of the that the goal of this report that we would bring is to look into that aspect of how well are our existing infrastructure ready and accessible. And people view this an asset-based approach to Minnesota. And then I also would recommend that we look at some really good suggestions coming out recently on this very topic about creating ethnic cultural heritage tourism, a concept of developing the global capital that you had many hearings on over the past few months about how we can view these assets, have these assets to make Minnesota a globally cultural state, because the Minnesota Chamber has been giving presentations on their study around the state, and one of the things I've been hearing is that global corporations who come to this state need this global cultural environment too for their employees, for them to do business.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. Absolutely. I think this is, I am so glad that you brought this document. I think the intent here, first, welcome Senator Carlson. We're delighted that you are here with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
The idea here, as you recall, members, was to build on what we have, because it's going to be very difficult to really look for new resources in light of, you know, the challenges that we have with deficits that we are going to have to deal with. So I think this is precisely, Dr. Corey, what we need to be looking at, you know, kind of the decisions that have been made by previous administrations, the existing resources that we have. I received a letter recently that I believe it might be in your packets. If not, we will make sure that you get it. And personally, I am fully aware of the resources that exist within the different administrations. We have a tremendous talent within these different departments of people who are from the community, who have worked with the community for a number of years, and who knows these issues, who know these issues quite well. And we intend to tap into these resources to really look at kind of the future of these particular programs and how we can begin to create better collaboration, particularly between these different agencies and the private sector and some of the nonprofit organizations and some of the private groups that are working in different areas with refugees and immigrants. So that's very definitely something that we intend to do, and I think the report that we had, the draft, kind of built on that. One thing that I want to make sure members remember is that we really want this particular report to be a very practical, very task-driven report, in a sense that we do not want to perhaps waste the opportunity that we have to simply say, you know, we really need to embrace, you know, new cultures and need to, we've said that already. We have multiple reports. What we want is a very specific set of recommendations to really look into restructuring and amending policy that could really enhance the current system that we have. So even if we only put a few recommendations, we want them to be very practical in nature and built again into what we already have. Any other comments from other members? Okay. So because our time is limited, we are going to try to go through these presentations and have kind of a five-minute question period built into each presentation. So we will start with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We are delighted that you're here, and we thank you for accepting our invitation. We were looking forward to really hear more about all of the great work that you're doing, and very definitely we plan to work with the different committees that you work with, Commissioner, in terms of we know that this is just a commission, so we have a very limited scope of practice, per se. So right now we just want to make sure that hear from you, and then we're going to give you about 10 to 12 minutes to the entire group, and then we will devote about 5 minutes to questions, and then we will move into the next, which is Department of Health. Welcome.
Senator, thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And as the Senator indicated, we work in this area extensively. Many of our 55 programs have some aspect of them that serve new Americans. We also work with many partners, the 16 workforce investment boards around the state, the Governor's Workforce Development Council, our educational partners, particularly adult basic education, and others. I'm going to emphasize some programs that are particularly targeted to new Americans. That doesn't mean there isn't probably even more work going on in basic programs like job seeker services and unemployment insurance and economic development. I'm going to work from a short PowerPoint slide deck that was provided to you for your packet. And the order in which I'm taking these doesn't imply that some are more important than others. It's simply the order in which we put the information together. I will try and indicate where the programs are funded. I don't always know the exact dollar amount. We can get those for you if you're interested. The first program in the presentation is work we do with migrant and seasonal farm workers. That's increasingly becoming migrant and seasonal food processing plant workers. There are still jobs in the farm, but with the advent of Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup Ready sugar beets and fruit picking equipment, the real use of this program is in packing plants like Seneca Foods and Green Giant and others. An example of that is that our staff estimates that early in this decade, we may have had as many as 20,000 migrant farm workers here seasonally. Our best estimate, and this is not an easy number to come up with, but in talking to people in our workforce centers, there are between 5,000 and 10,000 people in this population currently. Our involvement is through federal Wagner-Peiser and Workforce Investment Act services to provide bilingual and multilingual staff in workforce centers where there's a concentration of people that identify themselves as migrant and seasonal agricultural workers. We currently have full-time staff in Mankato, Wilmer, Rochester, and Faribault, and serve nearby workforce centers through collaborations with those workforce investment boards. One role we have is to inspect and certify to the U.S. Department of Labor housing provided as part of these arrangements, and we have one housing advocate who does that work. We're also have a new program that came from our work in workforce centers. It's called the New American Project, and it's to address workers that have barriers to employment that are best addressed through our vocational rehabilitation project. It is housed with three full-time employees at the St. Paul Workforce Center on Fairview and University, but works throughout the metropolitan area. By far the largest population with whom they work are Somali immigrants and other East African populations. They do have a handful of clients. They'll work with any immigrant or new American that needs their help. They have a small number of clients from Pakistan, Trinidad, Jamaica, Iraq, Congo, and Cameroon. But it started as a way to help those in the East African immigrant community who may have had accessibility barriers, needed assistance with mobility, wheelchairs, hearing devices, assistive technology for limited vision to access the workforce. And there are a lot of partners that are also involved in this work. And I don't mean to imply it doesn't happen in Greater Minnesota, but it happens in other places with our regular voc rehab staff. And in the metro, we have some specialized and multilingual staff that works in that area. We've placed particular emphasis in the last 2 years, 2009 and 2010, with helping new American young people learn about work, develop some work readiness skills, develop some work experience, hopefully increase their interest in continuing to finish high school and in getting post-secondary education. The most robust of these partnerships have been in southeastern Minnesota and in the metropolitan area. Some examples include the Somali community had a contingent in the Minneapolis Step Up program with 10 youth participating. Wonderful organization we work with, African Community Services, had 80 people in our Minnesota Summer Youth Program, all in the metropolitan area. The Hmong American Mutual Assistance Association had 20 youth in the Summer Youth Program. We've gotten always had a small appropriation from state funds for this. It's been $3 million a year in recent years. We had additional federal ARRA dollars in late 9 and most of 10. And then this year, for the first time, have some TANF dollars to assist young people in TANF-eligible families with their first work experience. There's a fair amount of research evidence that young people who have work experience in their teenager years are more likely to go on to post-secondary education and report post-secondary employment success. In southeastern Minnesota, we had a summer readers program and a math camp in the Winona area that had 40 people participating. A number of our other youth programs serve new Americans, but they aren't in specific programs. They simply have signed up and are served. We served about 2,500 young people statewide in summer youth in the summer of 10. It will be different funding for 11 and 12, but we're hoping to keep up those numbers. We won't have ARRA money. We will have TANF dollars and some state workforce development dollars. We also work very closely with adult basic education. And as you may know, adult basic education is essentially reinventing itself in the last number of years. It used to be thought of principally as providing general equivalency degrees or GEDs for those who had dropped out of school. It is now much broader clientele than that, still does general equivalency degrees. We heard some testimony during our summer meetings that 10 to 12% of the degrees granted in 2010 were GEDs, which was a surprisingly large number to me. I used to refer to their language program as English as a second language until one of their counselors explained to me that for many of her clients, English was their third, fourth, fifth, or sixth language. So now I refer to the program as English Language Learners, and which is the description that they use, and it's a robust part of their program. We're even more excited about the vocational aspects of adult basic education. And on the next slide in your packet is described something called Fast Track. Fast Track was started by the Joyce Foundation. We got our first Joyce planning money, I think, in 2007. It's now principally funded with federal funds through the Workforce Investment Act, through some federal ABE dollars, through a Workforce Investment Act incentive grant. But it connects people in adult basic education to vocational training. We just had 10 grants of about $100,000 issued. We had 19, I believe, applications all over the state. It's been a very exciting program. When Fast Track started, we thought it was just one of those grants that will come, be funded, and it will go away. It's really changing how we do business between workforce centers, our agency, community and technical colleges, and ABE. So that ABE isn't the end of the road for a lot of people. It's an entry to technical college, community college. Examples of Fast Track programs, many of which have very large new American clientele, would include programs done for certified nursing assistants, for pre-manufacturing training, for bank clerk and financial worker training. Partners include, in central Minnesota, for example, the Mille Lacs Band is involved, Brainerd Lakes Community College, and two ABE consortiums. This is an exciting development. Increasingly, many employers are looking for a work readiness credential that certifies someone has passed an exam indicating they have some basic work soft skills, basic workplace English, and some computational skills. Many of our ABE partners work with workforce centers to do work readiness credentials. We are hoping that we can keep Fast Track going. You mentioned recommendations, Madam Chair. It's not likely that Joyce will fund this in the long term, so we'll have to continue to find state and federal resources to keep Fast Track moving. Another robust portion, part of what we do, is to help new Americans who are entrepreneurs. Doesn't take long, whether you're in downtown St. James and see that the two busy restaurants are a longtime American cafe, my hometown cafe on one side of the street, and a Chicano Latino cafe on the other side, and about half the immigrant or the customers in each are English speaking and half are Spanish speaking, and it is exciting to see that. We see new American entrepreneurs succeeding all over the state. We help them through the Small Business Development Centers. We have 9 of those around the state. And in the metro area, we have a financing program particularly for, principally for new Americans. It's almost all minorities. Most of them are, or many of them, new Americans. It's called the Urban Initiative Program. We work with the list of partners shown here. The most active are the African Development Center, MEDA, Women Venture, the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. which includes the Latino Economic Development Association, SPARC in St. Paul, the St. Paul Area Redevelopment Corporation. We did 33 loans in 2009. I haven't seen the total for 10 yet. 10 obviously isn't over, but I suspect it will be higher than that. The loans range from $3,500 to $125,000. The businesses range from small retail grocery stores or hair braiding businesses to electrical contractors, a trucking company. Probably our most notable success story is La Perla, the tortilla makers, started with a $5,000 loan from this program perhaps 10 years ago, and today are a very substantial company with the last I knew about 100 employees and a great success. It's a program that is not just a revolving loan program, but also provides technical assistance, counseling, and mentoring to new business people. We've done a lot of work in our agency with trying to be more helpful to those with limited English or who do not have English. Our dislocated workers program helps people who've lost their job and need job training, intense counseling, classes. The materials for that are, all of them are available in 7 languages. We have worked in 17 languages. Unemployment insurance routinely provides written documents in 9 languages. I get about a dozen questioning calls or emails, why do we include this sheet of the languages in which our unemployment insurance is mailed in every mailing? You must know I speak English. Why are you bothering me with that? Well, we don't know who speaks or reads and writes English. And we put the English translation of the simple statement, this material also available in your language, just ask, on the bottom of the sheet in English. And we have gotten some complaints. Why are you providing this in other languages? We're provided because people need it in other languages. And this is nothing new in Minnesota. One of my hobbies is Minnesota history, and I read not long ago that in 1900, the instructions for the governor's election were in 10 languages. Not the same 10 that we would use today, but in 10 languages nonetheless. And so we spend a fair amount of time, effort, and money making sure our services are available. In unemployment insurance, we have multilingual employees that can assist us in Hmong, Somali, and Spanish. And then we use a national service called the Language Line, and it has been extremely helpful. One of the services they provide is to assist us in identifying the language of a customer who may need our help and then arranging a translator. Their translators work largely from their homes all over the country, and they pride themselves on being able to get us a translator in their 17 principal languages within a couple of minutes of our calling them, and we've been very satisfied. I think our customers have been satisfied with that service. We also get funding through the legislature for a number of organizations that we refer to as pass-through grants. Money appropriated, the language in the bill would say appropriated to the Department of Employment and Economic Development for a grant to. LifeTrack Resources is a longtime partner of ours. They currently get $100,000 a year from the Workforce Development Fund and $200,000 a year in the general fund, or $600,000 for the biennium for workforce-related services. They partner with a wide variety of entities that serve new Americans. MEDA and Women Venture both get grants. I believe they're $200,000 a year to assist in their work. MEDA and Women Venture are both also providers in our Urban Initiatives program. We also have had many grantees that work in the New Americans program from the Job Skills Partnership. I pulled just a handful of recent Job Skills Partnership grants. We set aside $1 million a year for a different kind of Job Skills Partnership that amount essentially to training vouchers for low income, usually not yet employed Minnesotans, many of them new Americans. The examples I pulled were 2 International Institute of Minnesota grants to work with nursing assistants and respiratory therapists. Their principal clientele have been East African immigrants, and we have done this twice with them, once in 2008 and once in 2010. The Somali Success School has worked with Dakota County Technical College to provide assistance for East African immigrants in CNA and other medical track careers. The African Assistance Program and a private for-profit school called the Accelerated School of Nursing Assistants and Home Health Aides working with Minneapolis Community Technical College and the New American Medical Academy, has had two grants from that program in recent years. We're also receive a pass-through appropriation and have a statutory program for the Opportunity Industrialization Centers. And some of you may know that the Eastside OIC had long served a Spanish-speaking clientele that was dissolved this last year, and the state OIC Council is in the process of working with community groups to create a new Spanish-speaking, Chicano-Latino-oriented OIC that will work in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly how much we get for each of those, but we can provide that information. The money is distributed by our agency, but with the advice of a statewide OIC Council that's been around for about 20 or 25 years and has been very helpful. I think that concludes my formal remarks. I would like to call another document. Bruce Corey brought some documents to your attention. We'll provide this to your staff, but it's a report done by the Governor's Workforce Development Council and a report issued in June of 2006 entitled Integrating Immigrants and Refugees into Minnesota's Economy and Culture. It might provide some additional background in your work. Senator and members, with that, I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We really appreciate all of this information. Members, before I ask my question, are there any questions you have for the Commissioner? Maybe, you know, this is a lot of information we need to digest. Commissioner, wanted to take this preliminary step to kind of get our hands around this information, which clearly is extensive, quite complex. But I do have a request, and in fact, I was given, or maybe we pull out from your website some documents that are simple charts that gives us kind of an overall overview of the resources that you currently receive. And I am very interested in having a current kind of a broad overview of your budget as it relates to these programs. And the reason I think is important is, I don't know if I heard this correctly. Let me give you a for instance. I didn't quite know that you have significant funding coming for at-risk youth programs. And if I heard you correctly, you said that you receive originally $3 million to work with these programs, and then that you currently serve 2,500 youth. I think this is pretty significant, and I am very interested in knowing more about this particular program, because oftentimes we just don't look at your department as a department who would be involved with youth. So I am quite interested in figuring out how do we understand the different programs that are now available through you, through your department, and how they kind of intersect with others, because I think our proposal, our report intends to look at how do we leverage resources and how do we connect staff, not just from the different state agencies, but also with the counties and the different foundations that are currently working on similar issues. And I think this will be of tremendous help to us if we could get an overview of the existing resources. Is that a possibility?
Senator, absolutely. We'd be happy to provide that. I want to make clear that our work with youth is as it results or relates to work. And we work closely with the 16 workforce investment boards, with the, I think it's 26 or 27 ABE consortiums, and with the Minnesota Department of Education and MNSCU in this area. The dollars that we get are $3 million a year of state dollars. Mm-hmm. Plus, there is a WIA youth title, Workforce Investment Act youth title, that provides some ongoing federal funds. Mm-hmm. Then in the last 2 years, we've had some one-time federal funds. We had, I believe, $10 million in ARRA stimulus dollars that allowed us in the summer of 2009 to put more youth to work. And in summer of 10, we had some one-time dollars for the Temporary Aid to Needy Families program that we work with the Minnesota Department of Human Services on. And for only either TANF eligible adults that needed a connection to work, and in some cases for teenagers that are residing in TANF eligible households and needed work experience. But we'll provide an exhibit, Senator, that details those dollars. One challenge in that program is it is has been a moving target as to where resources are available, and it has often had pilot dollars. That's how the Joyce Foundation dollars started for Fast Track. We are looking at the TANF as an experiment. We had to get permission from the U.S. Department of Human Services to do that. We want to thank our partners at the Minnesota Department of Human Services for their suggestion. We have a lot of the connections, so we work closely with them. We also work with the Department of Public Safety's youth programs that are a little different, but at times are an opportunity to connect young people to work for the first time.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know Representative Gardner has a question. This is exactly why we need your help, because I think we have really a tremendous opportunity to look at, you know, how do we strengthen those connections. You describe very eloquently the challenges that we face in terms of figuring out, you know, do we have only temporary money? Do we receive it from the feds? Is the state, you know, participating in that? Is the county helping with the process? So we want to really be able to put our hands around it so that we can put together recommendations that may help us look into future collaborations and really perhaps efficiency within this so that we can really utilize the dollars we have more effectively. I think Representative Gardner had a question.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your comments about being a history buff, too. That would be me, too. I wonder if you could help me. One of the cities I represent is Llano Lakes in Anoka County, which recently passed this resolution making English the official language, and they won't translate anything in other languages. And I don't think it's particularly helpful personally. But I wonder if you can help me articulate why it is a good thing for jobs in the economy generally and economic development to be accommodating in other languages as a state agency.
We do it for two reasons. One, it is a customer service issue for us. If we do not provide translated materials, then it happens that our customers have to find a child, grandchild, neighbor, church sponsor to be on the phone with them and translate for them, and then we never quite know if it's accurate or not. And so we can provide better customer service faster and more efficiently if we are good at languages. And it's also been an opportunity to increase the opportunities we can offer to people with the language skills in unemployment insurance and a couple of our other programs. I didn't get into a lot of economic development discussion, but our ability to attract and keep good-paying jobs in greater Minnesota to some extent has been directly related to immigrant workforces. JBS Swift in Worthington would not be growing the way they are, and they've gone from slaughtering 17,000 hogs per day to headed to 25,000 with a workforce that has a heavy New American component. Multilingual workforce staff there, a sensitivity to welcoming these new Americans. It's a unionized facility. It pays reasonably well. There's housing going up in Worthington. It's the right thing to do for economic development. We say the same thing at Northwest Poultry in Pelican Rapids. That's a Genio turkey store operation that has a significant new American component to their workforce. Northwest Poultry is a JobZee site, and we probably wouldn't have been in Minnesota without JobZee. Suzlon Wind Energy in Pipestone is in JobZee and probably wouldn't be there without that and has a significant new American component to their workforce. So it's been an important part of economic development, particularly in greater Minnesota. We're also constantly excited about the entrepreneurial willingness to work. and willingness to take on new businesses that we see all over Minnesota, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and first and some second ring suburbs, and in the regional centers with larger new American populations in greater Minnesota. So the short answer to your question, Representative Gardner, is we do it because we can't fulfill our mission of helping individuals, businesses, and communities if we can't do languages.
Commissioner, thank you. Dr. Corey.
I have three questions, Senator and Commissioner.
Dr. Corey, good morning. It's nice to see you again.
Always a pleasure to meet you. And I hope in my earlier comments you may have got a hint or may not have got a hint of frustration, because it's about 10 years we've been talking about a new way of thinking, and still we have a Lino Lakes kind of legislation being implemented where people don't seem to be getting it.
Dr. Corey, if I could, this is not a new problem. In May of 1858, a senator from Missouri arose on the floor of the United States Senate and said, "I oppose statehood for Minnesota. It's full of Norwegians and other savages who barely speak English." So this is not a new problem. And we had a robust immigrant welcoming kind of environment through the 1920s. And then we went from 1920 to the Vietnam era without welcoming many immigrants, and we forgot that it was part of our culture. Now, that's talking about, and this gets confused because of the issue of managing borders and because of legal or documented or undocumented immigrants. Set that aside. That's not what's important. What's important is there are an awful lot of people who are lawfully working in our community that we need to make maximum advantage, and I see it as much opportunity as challenge. Excuse me for interrupting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. That's correct. Dr. Corey, we're going to move, because we have two more departments. So, Dr. Corey, please, your question.
Senator, I understand your desire to move fast, but I also understand the slowness of this committee and the need to address some issues that need to be taken. And I would request, even if we go beyond time, this is a very important institution of the state, and we need to talk about it as much time as we need, regardless about the time frame of the committee. So that's my frustration about the process as going extremely slow. And we're not getting things done. So I have a couple of questions that I would like, maybe from your experience. First, if we could get an estimate of foreign investments, direct investments in Minnesota, like SR Steel, and how much the kind of jobs and creation that they do, it'll be helpful for our report. We get a sense whether, from your perspective, about the role of cultural heritage tourism and how that could be an engine for growth for Minnesota. And also, how could deed be changed to reflect this new global environment? I mean, this is an important machinery of the state to implement economic development. And how could that change? For example, should we be requiring that an employee of deed or a percentage of deed know a second language or have a worldview of either culture? Because that's how we are going to compete about the future. So how, in your experience, because you've got a very rich background and you've seen the world, how should you see this organization changing to be receptive to the future?
Dr. Corey, I would advise that the first change is probably more local than that, and we would encourage this working group and all of you to help us. We are challenged often to recruit new Americans to the local workforce investment boards. We have 16 of them, and they range in size from 20 to 30, and there are relatively few new Americans on those boards, and we need them. We also have youth councils, and I think 6 or 7 of the larger workforce investment areas, and those would need help. I would have concerns about a requirement that all of our employees are multilingual, but I assure you that we make that one of our selection criteria, particularly for customer-facing positions. For interior-facing positions, we're less likely to do that. We'll be happy to provide a summary of what we know about foreign direct investment. It almost needs to be put in two categories right now, and that's mining and mineral-related, and those are extremely large numbers, but they're all awaiting. I shouldn't say that. All but SR and Kobe Steel are awaiting environmental work. The SR project has its environmental permits and is moving ahead. It's about a $2.3 billion investment over the next 3 or 4 years. It's 3,000 to 4,000 construction jobs, 700 permanent jobs, plus some long-term employment. A large number of highly skilled, they're looking for millwrights, for example, and experienced steelmakers. Kobe Steel is a joint venture with Steel Dynamics in White Lakes, and that's up and running. About 100 jobs, most of them hired in the Hibbing and Virginia area. The largest project will be Antofagasta in Ely. That's an underground copper nickel mine that does not yet have its environmental permits. It's an investment in the early stages in the range of $2 to $3 billion. In the long range, I hate to think how much. It could be $10 to $25 billion. It'll be one of the largest copper nickel underground complexes in the world. They have 150 years of ore, but they have to get some fairly significant environmental work successfully completed. PolyMet is a Canadian company, but largely funded in Europe. They have an EIS in process. Soonest it would be completed is late 11. Soonest Duluth out of Ayasta would be completed is in probably sometime in 12. In other foreign direct investment, I've dropped a couple of names. The Suzlon in Pipestone, Upanor, a Finnish company, is very active in Minnesota. There are lots of others. I'll ask our trade office to do a summary. We're the wrong people to ask about cultural tourism, very honestly. The Explore Minnesota Tourism people, John Edmonds' office, is the expert there, and they get most of the impact information. So they would be able to help you with that question, Dr. Corey.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Senator, Commissioner John Keller, I have a couple of quick questions, and these will probably be standing questions for the rest of the persons providing testimony as well. If possible, if you're able to provide additional information to this working group, could you break out the percentage of programs and dollars per ethnicity if you keep those statistics?
We probably don't, because we don't have, unlike the census, and even the census has some limited ability. We can ask questions, but people don't have to answer them. And fewer than 50% of people, for example, applying for unemployment give us their race. They simply choose not to answer. On some of our forms, fewer than 50% choose to give us their gender. And unless the law requires it, we don't generally have a lot of that information. What we have is anecdotal. A counselor telling me my customers appear to be largely from wherever they're from. I'm not sure I would think it would be a good idea to mandate it. I think we would frighten some potential customers. But when it's self-identified, a lot of people choose not to provide us with that data. Mm-hmm. Now, the data you have seen of late about unemployment by ethnicity is census data, and they do have some authority to ask and keep asking. We don't have that authority. I'm not sure I want it.
Is it, Senator?
Mr. Keller.
Is it possible that some of the program funding is specific for ethnic groups or not?
Madam Chair, some of it is clearly directed to, for example, urban initiatives for low-income areas in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the first-ring suburbs, and our partners' connections are to communities that are largely ethnic. I can't think of any federal funding that says it's only available to new Americans, for example, or to ethnic groups, but it may be a type of program where that's the need. Summer Youth, for example, or any of our youth programs are available to anyone in the community that signs up, but they tend to, in our youth programs in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, we simply attracted a lot of customers who came who are new Americans.
Thank you.
But none of the funding is... funding is for types of programs rather than describing the ethnicity of the population. And in our pass-through grants, it's to vendors who have a history of working in particular communities, but it's not ethnic specific.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think it might be helpful, if the members agree to this, that in shaping this kind of broad, I don't know how to call it, kind of chart, maybe we can get together with some of your staff and maybe provide a frame so that your staff, really does not end up doing more than necessary, mm-hmm. but hopefully enough so that we have an understanding. For instance, as you speak, Commissioner, it occurs to me that we might have to pull some of the legislative mandate for those and some of the federal language, because if we intend to kind of look at overlaps that exist today, maybe there is an overlap in the language, you know, that describes the state funding or something like that. I don't know. But it will be helpful for us to kind of go over this and say, you know, this is helpful. This, you know, we don't need to go that far. Or your staff could help us kind of answer some of these questions like you just did, saying, you know, that information does not exist. So let's don't go into pursuing something that may not even be there.
And, Madam Chair, a couple of thoughts. The budget officers at Minnesota Management and Budget, they're called EBOs, Executive Budget Officers, unless, of course, they're new, and then they're called EBOTs, Executive Budget Officers in Training. Or if they've been there a long time, they're called EBOSs, Executive Budget Office Senior. They know where the money flows across agencies, and we're more than happy to help, but I think Commissioner Hansen's team may give you better information. Going back to your question, the one area that is specific are the councils of color that get appropriations from the legislature. And the executive directors or chairs of those councils might be helpful to you because they already follow some of that, those issues. And some of the challenge we face with self-identification, they may know more about than we do.
Thank you.
We probably have the tightest relationship with the Chicano Latino Council, and they, in fact, are in the process of translating one of our How to Start a Business in Minnesota documents into Spanish. We communicate frequently with the Asian Pacific Islander group, less frequently with the Council for Black Minnesotans. And we have a, although they're not new Americans, we do work closely with the Minnesota American Indian Council because we have an American Indian Entrepreneurs Fund that I didn't mention in this material. They're a minority community, obviously not an immigrant community.
Yes. And Commissioner, I just happened to attend a meeting a week ago with the councils, and in a way, the challenging part with the councils is that they are so small, so they cannot do a lot of work. But it was a lot easier to ask for the report, so we have it. We pretty much know kind of their mission and their allocation, so we have that information with us. And they, in fact, have come to us to ask about the future, you know, kind of collaboration that they are planning to propose in terms of working with communities of color. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks
really
for inviting us.
I appreciate the information. Okay, members, now we move into the presentation by the Minnesota Department of Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for bringing the information. So we are delighted you're here. And I'm sure it's going to be a lot simpler and shorter and easy to understand than economic development. So welcome. Please introduce yourselves and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Ayersman, and I'm actually a granddaughter of a new American, but not a savage Norwegian. It's a polite Swede. So anyhow, I'm the division director for the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I appreciate the opportunity to give you some background about the work that we do at the department on behalf of new Americans through our refugee health programs. The goal of the Minnesota Department of Health Refugee Health Program is to control communicable diseases among and resulting from the arrival of new refugees to Minnesota. And so to this end, we oversee administration of a domestic refugee health assessment. And what that is when refugees arrive in the state, there's the need for a medical screening, a health assessment, to make sure that they've been screened for various infectious diseases, as well as if there are other underlying health conditions, that those are identified and that individuals can then be directed to other health services. And the goal of this is really to identify and treat any problems that might interfere with that refugee's resettlement. Obviously, if someone has a health problem, that really challenges their ability to obtain employment or attend some of the necessary classes. And then secondarily, we want to protect the health of Minnesotans so that if there was a possibility of having you know, an infectious disease brought in, that we can control that. And then also we want to make sure that we've provided linkages for refugees to our healthcare system. And our program has an objective that 85% of all refugees will have received that health assessment within 90 days of arrival. So within the first 3 months of coming to Minnesota, that they will have had a health screening. And I can tell you that we've exceeded that goal, and that we routinely run in the 95-96% range. And so that's actually the best in the country for achieving results for refugee assessment. The other thing that we want to make sure is that providers who are doing these assessments receive the education and technical consultation that we need. And to that end, we've developed a Minnesota Refugee Health Provider Guide. So it's a guide for any providers who might be doing a refugee health assessment. It's quite comprehensive. And then for those providers that want the Cliff Notes version, we have a pocket card as well that provides them with some of the key information they need for that screening process. And then for the individuals who are being screened, the refugees, we have materials for them. It's a health guide for refugees in Minnesota, and we have it translated into a number of the key languages. And so it really explains the process of how the healthcare system works, what to expect with your screening exam, all those kinds of things. So a resource for individuals who are new to Minnesota. Our funding comes from four different sources. We receive state funds through the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, and that supports grants to local public health agencies. As refugees are arriving in Minnesota, as you heard from the Commissioner of Deed, they're working, or they're moving to many, many parts of the state. And so our local public health agencies are oftentimes the organization that's helping them get connected with their health care, and so, or with other services. And so those grants help local public health as they work with refugees, as well as deal with TB issues. Then we also receive funds from the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement that supports some of our staff and also local public health. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Human Services that provides funding to pay for medical screening for individuals that don't have a source of payment, and then also supports our staff. And then in addition, we wrote for a special federal grant from the Centers for Disease Control called Strengthening Surveillance for Infectious Disease in newly arrived Refugees. And this has funded a data collection tool that we have that helps us with our collection of our screening surveillance data, educational efforts, staff, and grants to some local agencies. And having told you that we have four different sources of funding, I want to just clarify that we only have four staff in the program. So although we have four different sources of funding, they're not large sources of funding, but they do fund the four staff that we have that are quite phenomenal and get a lot done. I'll just give you a short overview of some of the things we do, and then Ann O'Fallon, who's the director of our program, will give you more detail. But for instance, when the number of new arrivals to Minnesota is high, so if you think back when we had the large influx of Hmong refugees coming from the Watt, our refugee health program set up clinical systems, provider training, things to sort of expedite the screening process. So knowing that we would have thousands of refugees coming who needed that screening exam within 90 days, we helped to set up systems that would facilitate that process. In the last several years, newly arrived refugees to Minnesota has declined because of some changes in federal policy. And since that has happened, we've directed our efforts toward provider education, translated materials, refugee education. And so, you know, we make sure that there's articles in our ethnic media. We have folks that arrange for programs on health programs on radio shows. We participate in the English language learner classes, and our website has a great deal of information on language access and cultural competency. And as a result, we've really sort of created or recreated our program to be a national resource for refugee health issues, and are seen as such by the Centers for Disease Control. And although our work is really directed toward primary refugees, the work really benefits secondary refugees and immigrants as well. And so we see our role as While our direct assignment is to make sure that refugees receive medical screening, that our role really is broader than that. And so although the primary goal of our program is to ensure that refugees receive that important health assessment in the first 90 days after arrival, we also work to ensure that they can successfully navigate the healthcare system and remain healthy long beyond that time. So with that, I'll end, and I'll turn it over to Ann O'Fallon.
My name is Ann O'Fallon, and I coordinate the Refugee Health Program at the Minnesota Department of Health, as Chris said. And I want to thank you so much for giving me a chance to come here and tell you about our work. I'm going to give you a little bit of demographic information that we collect in our program, and a little bit is about immigrants, but largely the focus is on refugees since that's the nature of our work. But in the United States, about 12.5% of the population is foreign-born, whereas in Minnesota it's about 6.5%, although it's been increasing since 2000 in Minnesota. So the distribution of foreign-born populations nationally and in Minnesota are quite disparate. So you can see in the United States that the largest proportion of foreign-born people is people from Latin America. But in Minnesota, our largest population is persons from Asia, and we have a wealth of Asian nations represented in that population. From the post-Vietnam War era, where we had Hmong, Somali, Laotians, Cambodians, and Vietnamese, now currently we're getting people from Burma and from Bhutan, a whole different Southeast Asian population coming to our state. We also have a very significant African population. We have some of the largest, we have the largest Somali population outside of Somalia, the largest Liberian population outside of Liberia, as well as other Latin American populations in our state. This just shows, I thought this would be interesting for you, the diversity of foreign-born populations in Minnesota. You know, led by people from Mexico, followed by people from Europe and East Africa, but the diversity of countries is phenomenal, and the larger slice of the pie really is all even smaller percentages of other ethnic groups. One of the reasons our program is so significant in our state is that Minnesota is unique in the high proportion of our immigrants who arrive with refugee status. And refugees are people who are fleeing persecution. They've fled their homeland, cannot return to that homeland because of a well-founded fear of persecution. And our federal government has created a humanitarian program for them, and that's the main source of our funding. There's the definition. So these are the countries that are producing a lot of refugees, and these are the states that are welcoming refugees. And Minnesota, for many years, was among the top five in this listing of states. But because of some changes in federal policies, we've dropped down significantly in the number of refugees coming here, and so we've fallen down this list. But this is my favorite slide, and I show it to you to give you the breadth of the program that the Minnesota Department of Health has. Following the Vietnam War in 1979, refugees started coming to Minnesota, and that yellow color that you see spread off across the bar graph is all people from Southeast Asia, all those Southeast Asian countries that I mentioned earlier following the effects of the Vietnam War. But over time, in the 1980s, you can see significant populations also starting to come from Eastern Europe, and that would be people from Kosovo and the former Yugoslavia. The green, kind of olive green parts of the slide are persons coming from the former Soviet Union. And those, if you are from those countries, if you are an ethnic Jew or you are a fundamentalist Christian, you can apply for refugee status and come to the United States, and many of them do. So you'll notice in Minnesota, I think on some of the handouts that I gave you, that significant numbers of these fundamentalist Christians are from former Soviet Union countries are settling in Anoka County and also in the Shakopee area. But then in the mid-90s, there's a big shift to refugees coming from the sub-Saharan African nations. And that shift continues through, till right now. In 2004, well, you can see 2002, our numbers were very low. That was following September 11th, and immigration across the country was very low. But then it bounced back up, and in 2004 was when we began to resettle refugees from Wat-Tam-Prabuk that Chris talked about. And that was offset by the also the arrivals that we had from sub-Saharan Africa during that time. And as Chris mentioned, you can see here starting in 2008, our numbers dropped again because of a shift in federal policy. And this year in 2010, we're going to be maybe hit around 2,000 arrivals. And that's our story. The numbers that I'm showing you are primary refugee arrivals. So those are arrivals who have come from overseas directly to Minnesota. Many, many refugees go first to another state and then decide to move to Minnesota. I would guess the numbers are at least equal to the numbers that I'm showing here, if not greater. And those, there's no notification, no tracking system for those individuals, so I don't know that they're here and we're not able to offer them a health screening. That's one of our goals for this year, is to develop a system of identifying these individuals and offering them a health screening the same as we would for our primary arrivals. So this was last year, the refugees who were coming to Minnesota, just broken out by their country of origin. We were led by people from Burma. There's a subset of Burmese people called the Karen, who are the most significant population of people coming here from Burma. It's followed by people from Somalia. We're still getting arrivals from the former Soviet Union. In 2008, we got our first arrivals from Iraq. But those populations are growing. There are a lot of them resettling in Rochester, Minnesota. There are some up in Pelican Rapids, and I believe some also in Anoka County. We're also
Ms. O'Fallon, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I am fully aware of the time. I really want you to concentrate on your presentation as it relates to healthcare. So I would like you to move quickly through these numbers. We have had the state demographer going through this.
All right.
So
thank you.
I want to make sure that we really leave time for the discussion around healthcare only.
Yes. All right. Great. Thank you. Well, you probably know about this. This just shows also where the refugees are going in the state. This is our health assessment. This is the system that we use to complete our health screenings. So we are notified by the Center of Disease Control about the new refugees who are coming here. We work in close partnership with the resettlement agencies. That would be places like Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Services, the International Institute, and local public health to reach each refugee, ask them if they would like to have a health screening, and if they would, we make all the arrangements for that to be done. In Rochester, in Olmsted County, and in Hennepin County, there are public health clinics that see the refugees there in their public health clinics for their screening. In all the other counties throughout the state, the refugees are screened in private clinics. So we are only able to achieve this high rate of health screening through the cooperation of our department, local public health, community-based organization, ethnic-based organizations, the resettlement agencies, and the clinics, the medical providers across the state of Minnesota. Chris made a reference to the Wat-Tam-Prabuk arrivals in 2004, and we did do outreach to many clinics to help us achieve our screening rate during that time. And one of the wonderful things was that there were, at that point, many Hmong people who had become physicians, and they had their own clinics. So they were able to help us screen many of the refugees because they had their own medical practices and had cultural and linguistic competence as well as medical competence to help screen our refugees. So it's only through tremendous partnership that we're able to achieve what we have been able to do. I wanted to show you some of the educational tools that we have created because they really reach across beyond just refugee populations. This is a media directory, diverse ethnic groups that have media resources, and I can pass these around if you'd like to see them. And this is all community-based mutual assistance associations throughout the metropolitan area, a listing. And these change rapidly, but it's a great resource for anyone looking for help or finding other people from their ethnic group. And this resource is clinics that provide care to non-English speaking populations. And this is a listing of 12 different counties are listed here, so all the medical clinical resources that are available in those communities. And then just as an example, this also cuts across all populations. We were instrumental in the health department in making sure that all the flu materials go out in many languages. So we actually have these out in 19 different languages that we've contributed to. This shows you some of the screening rates from the infectious diseases that we look for in our refugee populations. They come from countries that are endemic with infectious diseases, and we try to identify those and treat those diseases, and also really have made a great effort at helping to follow up refugees with chronic conditions or mental health conditions or other kinds of conditions that will need ongoing care once our screening is completed. So thank you very much.
Thank you. For either Ms. O'Fallon or for Kristen, so two sources of major work with refugee populations you mentioned, the Office of Health Disparities being one, and then epidemiology and this presentation so those are kind of the main entities within your department that deals with new Americans in terms of resources.
Madam Chair, yes. Within the Department of Health, we have the Refugee Health Program that is housed in the infectious disease area, and then there is also the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, which also addresses issues of health disparity.
Uh-huh. Okay. The Office of the Refugee Health Program is mainly funded through state dollars or federal or both?
Madam Chair, the Refugee Health Program is really predominantly funded through federal funds. There are funds that have been made available through the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, and those funds are really pass-through funds that go directly to local public health agencies. But in terms of the staff and the work that's done in the program, it comes through both the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a federal program, and then we receive pass-through funds, from the Department of Human Services, but those funds also originally came from the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And then we have written for a federal grant from the Centers for Disease Control, which actually is as much as or more than both of those other two sources of funding. So really it's federal funds that support the program.
Great. As with the Office of Economic Development, is there a possibility that we can work with you to create a chart that gives us an idea of kind of the populations and how specifically, you target your dollars, again, to see how when we put this picture, we're trying to put a puzzle together and we want to see how your piece kind of fits within this puzzle that we hopefully we will be able to create. And so in the puzzle, I'm envisioning kind of a good piece that belongs to health, because from what I see now, it's a very small piece that we might need to talk about enhancing and figuring out, how do we make sure that you do have the resources to do the work that needs to be done. And so I think I'm looking for a kind of a broad, but in a way, specific, if that can be said together, piece that describes kind of what you currently receive, and maybe we can look at some of your legislative language so that we can see how we may have, an opportunity or a gap in here to work in terms of, because it seems that from a statement you made at the beginning, that we are leading the nation in terms of getting the health screening done for about 85% of the population, which is remarkably good. And I think we need to learn about, you know, how few resources go into doing incredible work. 85% of the population is very good. And I would like to, since we have some disparities, I would like to know, we have that work that is being done by your division in a very comprehensive way, but then what happened? You know, many of these refugees may have jobs that don't offer health care, and then their health declines, and we've seen some reports that indicate that some new arrivals are very healthy, but then their health declines. So we may have to see about what do we do with that. You do a good job of assessing and letting us know, but then we don't have a way of tracking that. So that's something that I'm thinking that we might be able to do. Members, Dr.
Oh, Madam Chair, yes. Can I just clarify? So you're interested in both the funding sources, legislative language that may accompany that, and then also were you interested in more of the details of the program and how they break out by different population groups, or were you really focusing on funding?
I think both. Yeah, I think I think Mr. Keller was alluding to the fact that sometimes we might have to kind of focus resources in certain areas because we have some populations that may indicate, you know, they are younger or they have. You might tell us that through the screening you discover that some populations we need to work on getting the information to them or maintaining their health status. I don't know. But it will be very good, I think, to break down ethnic populations. I think Dr. Corey had a question, and then Representative, please, go ahead.
Quick question. Senator, the Office of Multicultural Health, I believe, was at one time in the Department of Health. Is that still there? And maybe how that office can play a role in some of the things that we want to do?
Yeah, definitely.
Madam Chair and Dr. Corey, actually, Jose Gonzalez, who is the director of our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, is here. And so if you have specific questions, I'd call on him to answer them. But I think that probably what is different or what is unique about the refugee health program within the department and some of the resources that we provide that sort of go beyond just the refugee population is there is a focus on that new American aspect. And that's not to say that our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health doesn't also address that, but I would say that the Refugee Health Program is reaching out and has its connections with the newest arrivals, obviously, and then has expanded on that to make sure resources are available for secondary arrivals and things. But, Jose, do you feel like that's a fair? Do you want to?
Thank you. Mr. Gonzalez, welcome.
Thank you, Jose Gonzalez. I agree totally with that. I do want to, have everyone appreciate that we have a lot of excellent staff and divisions within the Minnesota Department of Health. While Office of Minority and Multicultural Health looks at populations of color and American Indians overall in terms of health disparities, we do have an Office of Refugee Health that focuses in this population, but then also within our own work, we do come across a lot of the communities in the Asian Pacific Islander and the Latino communities specifically, and of course the African communities. So we do pay attention to all that, and we are trying to make sure that programs or activities we personally can't fund through an Eliminating Health Disparities initiative that we have, that our staff then connect with those different populations and try and meet their needs through other connections within the health department or other state agencies.
Thank you. And I think this is where we may have an opportunity in terms of how, you know, you conduct the assessments, as you said in the beginning, kind of looking at what this universe of people that come to the country. But then you deal with disparities, at the hearing we have in the House, we see how we have some significant representation of people of color, and some of these are second, third generation refugees that we are having to deal with their disproportionate, representation in areas like obesity or others. So I think we might have an opportunity to work on this and figure out how do we do a better job of connecting and providing resources to deal with the disparities later on. Mm-hmm. Representative Gardner had a question.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. I'm very glad to hear all this information. I think we have some really skilled people at the agencies working on different things. I think your goal is to try and get a bird's eye view of all the services that are available and what we're doing to actually help people fully integrate into the U.S. But I think it might be helpful either through a meeting or some other forum to talk to some of the not-for-profit providers of some of the services. We've seen them mentioned by Deed and mentioned by the Department of Health, and there's a list here on the healthcare services offered where these are the folks who are actually the portal for immigrant communities where they will come in and say, you know, I need help in a certain area. And so there must be people who have have that good bird's eye view of everything from health to education to economic development there, and the Council for Nonprofits would be a good conduit to maybe talk to some of those groups. I don't know that anybody's ever produced that big chart that we're all sort of trying to visualize, but they probably could give us a handle on some of the gaps and opportunities that we should be looking at.
Representative Gardner, do you think it will be helpful to ask the departments to give us, because particularly for economic development, it seems like they are partnering with a number of organizations that actually do the work. Do you think that we need to ask, as part of this report, to incorporate the agencies that they are funding, or?
More information is always better. I certainly would find it useful to find out all the entities that are providing services. They're not always immigrant-centered, but it would be helpful if we could talk to leaders of some of those groups. Certainly, John probably is familiar with some of them, and I think they would be some of the first people to say, boy, you guys are missing the boat. You know, the state agencies are good, but they have their particular silo and focus and mission, and our mission is to help folks take advantage of every opportunity that they have. Mm-hmm. So we could probably make a few strategic calls and contacts I just think by December, a lot of those groups will say, hey, why didn't you talk to us?
Right. Okay.
And we're going to find out that we didn't check. And I'd certainly be happy to check with you and other members here to find out the best way to do that.
We definitely will partner with you. Clearly, your office, Mr. Gonzalez, has agencies that you work with that provide a direct connection service, and all of you. So we will make sure that we incorporate that information into this report. You had a question, sir.
Senator, and thank you for the information. I think it's really helpful to get a perspective about the refugees entering and sort of just how what a great job the office has done in terms of just screening refugees. But I agree that I think it would be helpful to sort of think about kind of the long-term health issues, and knowing, we're talking about health insurance and all the renovations and health and really thinking about healthcare access, that I think those are also huge issues. And so thinking about maybe a broader stroke of understanding what is at health and all those other departments that really also play a critical role. I know you talked about sort of part of the screening process is helping refugees understand how to navigate into health insurance and all of those other services that might be available, but it might be helpful to see kind of that broader stroke. And I would also agree with Representative Gardner that maybe talking to or understanding who some of the community agencies are, but also some of the healthcare plans that are serving low-income communities, I think happen to serve a lot of immigrant and new Americans, and understanding kind of that kind of access would help us maybe understand some of the innovation that is happening or not happening around health. I met with one of the refugee families who just came from the Watt like 5 years ago, and you know, the grandmother of the family basically said, you know, coming to America has been good, but it hasn't been good for her health, right? Because, you know, just physically, she's doing less. And so, you know, she's actually getting, her health has deteriorated, right? So, you know, just asking her about kind of, does she understand where to go, you know, what things to do and things like that. So I think that would be an important aspect of also understanding health in a broader stroke.
Right, absolutely. And we do know from anecdotally, and I'm pretty sure that we can get the report, that a lot of new arrivals have part-time jobs that do not offer health care. And so we need to figure out, you know, how do we work with the Department of Economic Development to get the training, all of the resources that they, so that they could have access, or how the healthcare reform will impact or could make a difference in the long term? Yes, please.
Madam Chair, I just also wanted to comment that as part of our strengthening surveillance grant that we received from CDC, we did also, we have put some funds into a pilot project to work with counties to look at that sort of next step for our refugee arrivals, looking at, okay, you've had the screening process, but if you have underlying health conditions, how do we make sure that you are connected with secondary care? So although that's just the beginning, and as I said, somewhat of a pilot project, we can also include that in the report that we send you, because it may be a model.
Absolutely.
Future.
I think that will be very, very helpful. We need to go to the next presentation. Thank you so much. This was very, very helpful. And again, I am going to ask DHS to please concentrate your the Department of Education. Sorry about this. I think DHS is next week. to help us focus your presentation on kind of the key education aspect of refugees and new arrivals, so that we can have a pretty good picture of this is, and I'm going to ask for your patience. We may have to come back to continue this presentation. Dr. Corey, I know, wants us to continue today. And we try to put 2 hours, but we really need a lot more. But I do have to speak at an event at 11, so I have to step out. So I need to finish at 10:55 at least, so that I can walk across the street. So we're going to do our best to cover this, but we will set up a time quickly to come back and continue the presentation and go into the areas and maybe include an invitation to some of the nonprofit groups that need to be here. Welcome.
Senator Torres-Ray, committee members, I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Education. And with me today are a number of our staff members at the Department of Education who work on programs that have services targeted to new American and immigrant students. What I want to just point out that we've provided a handout that is the result of a conversation between Commissioner Segrin and Senator Torres-Ray. I think it was in May. You had called the commissioner and asked us to take a look at what services the department provides to immigrant students. And what we did was talked with all of the divisions at the department and asked them to write up just a brief summary of what specific programs there are at the department and how some of our broader programs do target services specifically for immigrant students. So we won't go into that entire report in detail, but Brad Haskamp from ABE will talk about some of the ABE programming at the department. Elizabeth Watkins from Special Education Policy will talk about the work that they're doing. And then Ruslana Westerland from the Consolidated Federal and Title Program Division. So I'm going to start with Brad.
Well, I have the honor of having Commissioner McElroy already giving me a little bit of preparation of my presentation. But I am Brad Haskamp, the Adult Basic Education Policy and Operations Specialist at the Minnesota Department of Education. And Adult Basic Education, often called ABE, is a program here at the Department of Ed that serves more than 78,000 adult learners per year. And programs are offered at sites such as public schools, community-based organizations, college campuses, prisons and jails, and a variety of other sites. And the programs that are served through ABE includes adults seeking English language learning, GED preparation and testing, math instruction, an adult high school diploma program, workforce preparation, family literacy, transitions to post-secondary education and training, and other basic skills like just reading and writing. And ABE serves roughly hundreds, if not thousands, of adult immigrants and refugees on a daily basis here in Minnesota. And let's talk about the biggest program being English language learning. It is by far our most popular program in ABE. Of our 78,000 adult learners we serve in Minnesota, 42%, or roughly 32,000, were studying English language learning. And ELL's programming is measured federally in six different levels, and I'm sorry to say that they're not as quick as we are here in Minnesota to use terms like ELL. And at the federal level, they still do use ESL. But they have every levels beginning at beginning literacy ESL that works with adults who maybe have never attended formal education before or may never have even held a pencil. And that goes all the way up to advanced ESL that may include immigrants and refugees who have higher levels of education and maybe just need a little bit of educational help or assistance to prepare them either for the GED, for employment, or for post-secondary education and training. This percent of 42% that I mentioned before, though, does not include adult immigrant and refugees who are not studying ESL, but maybe they are studying instead math instruction, GED preparation, or the work readiness skills. Another program I want to highlight beyond ELL, or maybe a facet of ELL, is our English Language and Civics Instruction program. We offer a competitive grant through federal funding for ABE programs throughout the state to apply for EL Civics Grant funding, which is a program that combines English instruction, workforce prep, and civics instruction. And the purpose of this funding and these grants are to ensure that immigrants and refugees have the opportunity to develop their language education, work skills, and local community understanding to succeed here as new Minnesotans. In this current year, we received roughly 40 applications, and unfortunately, we're only able to fund 21 projects throughout the state of Minnesota. The ELL Civics Grant is made possible, like I said, through federal grant through federal law and funding. This year, Minnesota was lucky to receive more than $800,000 from the Minnesota Department of Education marked for ELL Civics. Another program I want to highlight is our refugee grant, which is actually funded through the state through DHS. And that helps serve recent adult immigrant refugees, just refugees, who have arrived in the last year with their educational needs. And that program is an on-need basis where the local ABE programs get reimbursed for their services. Now, as Commissioner McElroy from Deed mentioned, transitions is one of the state initiatives in adult basic education, which focuses on transitioning our adult learners into employment, post-secondary education, and training. In programs like Fast Track, which is a great example, we are working with both Minsky campuses and Deed staff and workforce centers to provide seamless programming and ensure that adults can transition between systems effectively. As McElroy also mentioned, this is currently a temporary initiative with temporary funding. And it does require a lot of collaboration and a lot of effort, but we really see this as an important initiative, as an important innovation in our program, but across three systems. Just going more in-depth about the funding and the law, all of our ABE programming is made possible federally through Title II of the Workforce Investment, or WIA Act. And statewide through Minnesota Statute 124D.51. In total, ABE does extremely efficient work by serving more than 78,000 learners with about $50 million of combined state, federal, and grant funding. Looking more closely, it does cost less than an average of $678 per year to serve an enrolled ABE student. I mentioned service, but what about the success? How efficient are we and effective are we in our efforts? And we measure our success through educational level gains on standardized tests and attainment of life goals by our students. Using these measures and with annual standards set by the U.S. Department of Education and the Minnesota Department of Education, we've been very successful. For each of the past 6 years, ABE programming statewide has met or exceeded all of its federally negotiated performance goals and has earned a WIA incentive grant cash award for each of the past 3 years. These WIA incentive grant cash awards come from federal funds. So in the report that Amy mentioned before, I really want to encourage you to look at page six and seven that really highlight some of the additional resources in adult basic education, including the Adult Literacy Hotline, which can help you can help find your local program, the ABE website for Minnesota, contact information for our state ABE director, Barry Schaefer, and information about the Ronald Hub Center for Lifelong Learning, which is in St. Paul, but it's our largest ABE site in Minnesota. And it's really a magical place. Actually, all of our ABE sites throughout Minnesota are a magical place to visit. And you really see the comprehensive work that each of our programs are doing and the multitude of programs and the diversity and multicultural nature of the student of the students and the educational efforts that we have on a daily basis. Also, I did provide in the back of the room a document that provides a more comprehensive overview of adult basic education and includes a lot of information from this presentation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm just curious about the chart that you provide about the cost in page 3 of your document. Is this is the how you break down the state and federal grant and then enrollment, student contact hours, and the average cost per student? Is this something that you do regularly, or you did this to present today? Or is this something that you do on an ongoing basis, how you track this the way you...
We prepared this this document on an annual basis for our multitude of partners. This is by no means something special that we developed for this presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Gardner.
Just a quick question. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but is it fair to say that everybody who's a newcomer here who doesn't speak English as their first language has an unfettered opportunity to learn English in an ABE program?
Well, each local program, and we have programs throughout the entire state, they do have the opportunity to study English language learning at their local program, yes.
So there's nothing stopping anybody from learning English?
I would say that personally, I would say that every person has individual issues that they may or may not be able to study English, but we try to provide the resources so that if an adult has time, if they can carve out some time between their work schedule, their family schedule, and all their other obligations that they have in life to come learn English, we want to serve them. We have programs throughout the state to serve them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haskin. Please.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Watkins, and I'm representing the Special Education Policy Division today. I am the consultant for English language learners, immigrants, refugees, racial and ethnic minorities who have special education needs at the department. And it's a real pleasure to be here today. Many of you know probably that Minnesota has a long history of being a leader within the field of services for both adults and children with disabilities. Our state has also been a leader in considering the special issues of ELL and immigrant and refugee students in special education. The first guidelines in this area, I realize, were written in the 1986-87 school year, which means that we have been doing concentrated work in this area for almost 25 years now. All of our activities are supported with federal discretionary funds that come from the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Serving refugee and minority families are also a priority in our state performance plan for special education. We do, in addition, convene a diversity advisory committee, which provides guidance to us in various ongoing initiatives and policy areas that we are responsible for. I'd like to focus my very brief remarks on two areas: one, multilingual information and parent support, and the other, support for schools that are working with immigrant and refugee families. Within the area of multilingual information and support, the previous speakers talked about navigating the system, and that is certainly true in the field of special education, which has a lot of overlap. It's an education program, but also overlaps with healthcare and often with health human services as well. We do serve children from birth through age 21 with disabilities, and it's essential that their families be very actively involved in providing the input on their educational programs, but also that we meet legal standards for those families having informed consent, that they understand and are involved in making decisions about their child's education. To that end, one of the programs we've created, and this is something Senator Torres-Rey, when she was at DHS, we used to often discuss this area of specifically training interpreters and cultural liaisons who work in special education programs. They are the frontline staff at schools who work with families who are not completely fluent in English. And so for over 10 years, we've created and operated a program to train them in special education. That's something that is unique in the country. We also have developed glossaries of terminology in various languages, because in order to ensure accurate information, everyone first has to know what terms mean and how to interpret or translate them. We've maintained a database of interpreters for over 10 years. We create videos and DVDs in multiple languages, introducing families to special education issues, and we provide written translations of written notices, legal notices, and due process forms. We collaborate with a number of family advocacy organizations, most particularly PACER, which is the Parent Advocacy Coalition for Educational Rights. PACER is the largest organization in the state, but also one of the largest in the country. We provide financial support for them. They provide specific advocacy services for Hmong, Somali, and Spanish-speaking families. And they also provide training to other parent organizations around the region as well as in Minnesota. They are a regular partner for many and advise us on many of our programs, but we work with other parent advocacy organizations as well. Moving on then very quickly to talk about the work we do with schools, we have to ensure that every public school system throughout the state is able to appropriately identify and serve all students of any race or language background who have disabilities and are in need of special education services. To that end, we provide written guidance, we provide staff development on how to evaluate or determine whether individuals actually have disabilities or if they are grappling with language and cultural barriers that are preventing them from being successful in school. The interpreter training that we do also encompasses training interpreters to work with psychologists, speech clinicians, other licensed staff in order to carry out appropriate, non-biased evaluations using the student and family's native language. It's a very complex task, but it's something that we've really been able to increase our capacity and our knowledge in that area. And I'd also like to say that I am one of approximately 15 specialists. We have disability specialists in our division, compliance specialists in a different division. There are specialists in interagency services and funding. And really, the needs of immigrant and refugee students are embedded into all of the work of our division. It's my specific job, but I think truly I am part of a team that sees it as part of all of our jobs. And if at some point you need any further specifics or information, I'd be glad to provide that. I'll take a breath now. I'm watching my watch.
Thank you. Ms. Watkins, could you tell me if one of the reasons for why the department felt it was an important thing to do to incorporate a presentation about children with disabilities, is it that you have a high ratio of participation of immigrant children and refugee children in this division? The reason I ask this question is because I participated in a very heated discussion in Minneapolis about a week ago between teachers who are very upset about the high ratio of participation of immigrant children in disability programs that they suspect is inaccurate. And they believe that there are many children that have been labeled as a child with disability because they are children who come from communities that they don't speak the language, is what the teachers are saying, but they also come from very small communities, villages. They are from cultural backgrounds where these children really do not speak to authority. They have they have cultural norms that come from their families that in their view are viewed by the teachers as kind of lack of participation, effort, and they are labeled, these children are labeled as not capable of functioning in this cultural.
I have to say that, in fact, the opposite is generally true. When we disaggregate data by home language, we find that ELL students around the state, and also including in Minneapolis, tend to be underrepresented in special education programs. And in fact, there are one of the reasons we work on this is that there are barriers toward identification and outreach and providing services to these students and families. And so that is one of the reasons that we have focused on that. We do see more variation among rates of Latino students, but overall we do see that ELL are underrepresented in special education.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. And members of the committee, I just wanted you to know this is a particular sensitive discussion for Somali families where we have a vast number of children who have been diagnosed with autism, and parents are arguing that the diagnosis is not accurate. And then other ELL disability aspects around the Latino community. So I think this is an opportunity for us to really look into how those assessments are being conducted.
Yes.
You know, here you're saying, you know, an expert with whom I have worked for many, many years saying, you know, in fact, the opposite is true, that we have underrepresentation, that there are many, many children out there that are actually not receiving the services that they need, and that's why they are not performing in school. So we're going to have to bring this conversation, I think, to a place where we can really look at the trends, some of the statistics, and figure out could we produce a recommendation that can help you get, you know, to where you need to go, and also parents understand that maybe what we need is to invest resources so that we can do a better job of conducting assessments that are culturally relevant.
There are many misconceptions out there as to what exactly comprises special education services, and even within the area of, you know, what is the actual incidence rate of autism among the Somali community is up. There's a lot of debate and uncertainty about what those numbers actually are. I would recommend getting data from we have a full-time autism specialist who'd be happy to provide additional information in that area.
Wonderful. Thank you. If the group allows me to do this, I am going to ask Representative Gardner to finish the meeting, the hearing, if you don't mind, Representative Gardner.
I don't mind if you'd like to give some indication of what outcome you'd like us to have. Shall we just defer on when we set a next meeting? So we have more people, and I think we're all maybe you want to have some discussion of how the report would get written.
Yes.
But I'm happy to finish up so that we can have all the testimony.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. I'm thinking that what we need to do is really finish this presentation, because I think if we interrupt it, it will not have the same effect, and then ask the questions. So at least we can conclude this presentation. And then I believe that it will be appropriate for us to, through email, set up our next meeting, and through email, figure out how do we put together an agenda for the next meeting. It seems that obviously we have DHS coming to the next hearing. DHS is not here today. And then we may want to invite some of the nonprofit sectors. You know, PACER definitely will be a very good one in terms of looking at the education and get recommendations as to how we could invite people who are in the nonprofit sector who do this work with us. And then I would like to hear from you, members, as to who else. But I also think, Representative Gardner and members, that we need to have a working session so that we can really put all of these together and then begin to create the draft. We have a preliminary draft. Now we have to incorporate more recommendations in terms of policy recommendations, practical policy recommendations. And we may have to have a half-day retreat to really put these recommendations with staff so that it will be actually written as we speak and put the information, and we may invite some members of the different departments to help us put together these recommendations because you are the experts, and we may invite some representatives of the nonprofit sector. Would that make sense?
I think that's good.
Senator, would it make sense to, as we go through the department, for some members of the committee to volunteer to work with our department to pull together some information that may be needed for the work that people are working simultaneously as we're trying to get?
I think that that might be a wonderful idea in terms of developing some subcommittees, one or two members that can focus the work on specific areas and then bring those documents. So we will connect through email to do that work, but for now I think it will be good to finish this presentation and entertain questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Why don't you proceed?
I can.
We in the House are kind of loose, you know.
Run things. My name is Ruslana Westerlaw, and thank you for this opportunity to share about the programs that we have at the Minnesota Department of Education, especially in the area of consolidated have a good narrative in your packet that you can really focus on reading the details, and I will not read it for you, but just focus on some areas that are significant to bring to your attention, or maybe some changes have occurred since the report was written a while ago. So I will focus on Title III Language Instruction Education Program, which is a federally funded program for English language learners in K-12 schools. And one important factor you need to know is that there are 63,000 English language learners in Minnesota in K-12 schools, which comprises 7.6% of all the student population. Just so you understand that we do have large numbers of English language learners. The definition of an English language learner is not necessarily an immigrant who primarily arrived from another country, but a person who might have, who was probably still needs support in acquiring English, even if they were born in the United States, but speak a different language at home, and their lack of English skills might not help them access the core curriculum. So it's really in response to the Lau versus Nichols Supreme Court case from 1974 that said that English language learners need to have access to the core curriculum. If they don't, then the educational opportunity is denied for them. So we are in that's the Supreme Court case that kind of undergirds this federally funded program. We also have some state funding, and state funding actually runs out after a 5-year period to support English language learner programs. However, research indicates that it takes at least 7 to 11 years to really acquire English, because you mind you that it is English that is required for school academic success and not English as a foreign language as it is offered in other countries. So extra state funding would be great in closing the achievement gap for these learners based on the research that I could provide for you if you're interested. And so the purpose of this program is to improve the education of English language learners and immigrant youth by assisting children to meet challenging state academic standards and student academic standards. Title III Immigrant Grant is another formula grant that is part of Title III, but it's a set-aside 3% of the Title III funding that goes directly to immigrants, while ELL services were for all English language learners. Title III is just to immigrant children in K-12 schools, and they are given to districts that meet the eligibility criteria. I have the definition of the eligibility criteria probably in my report. No, I can provide if you're interested. Another interesting program that I really want to focus my attention on is called Refugee School Impact Grant. And the reason I'm excited about this is that the new iteration of this grant really calls for smarter and newer and innovative ways of providing services to refugees, and without reduplicating services or reinventing the wheel sort of approach. And what we're doing now, and I manage this grant, is we collaborate with DHS. We ask that school districts don't just do the duplicate the services that, for example, community-based agencies or mutual assistance agencies already provide to refugees and then just duplicate them in the school grounds, but rather to form a consortium. So the new award that Minnesota has just received for $800,000 for the first year with a continuation for another $800,000 for the second year is asking school districts to really collaborate with community agencies and really put heads together to come together and provide highly challenging needs that refugee students bring. And the focus will be on social-emotional development of refugee students, academic achievement, and language acquisition skills, because it's really a long process for students to acquire English in a short time. It is a long process, so we ask that the funds support some of that. Let me just skip through some of this.
And you would be the last presenter then? Just to,
yes, I am.
We may be losing people here pretty quick, so.
Excuse me?
We may be losing some people here pretty quick, so.
Yes, I am trying to be as entertaining as I can. With this. You can read about the migrant education program in the handouts. It's very well described there, but basically the goal is to ensure that all migrant students reach challenging academic standards and there are no disparities among states in curriculum, graduation requirements, state academic content standards, and that they graduate with a high school diploma that prepares them for responsible citizenship, further learning, and productive employment, and that's for migrant K-12 students. And then another one is the 21st Century Community Learning Center program. And that concludes my presentation. There is more details available in the report, or you may ask for further details from our division if you're interested.
And the report's very thorough. I'm looking forward to making sure I double-check everything there. Are there any questions? I'm guessing your first language is Russian?
Ukrainian.
I was going to say it's pretty close. It's a student there, so okay. I have a lot of Iron Rangers in my district for some reason, and they always remind me that Governor Perpich actually didn't speak English until he went to school on the range. So, I think the chair laid out what our next steps would be, another session with DHS and perhaps with some of the nonprofit providers, a working session to go over report draft and perhaps a retreat. And I think we'll all be looking forward to hearing from her or the staff to figure out what our next steps are. And I am going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you.